Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name's Peter Jones. I'm the chair for this session, and we've got all of our instructors or presenters complete. This session is on insurance accounting developments. We have three presenters, and I'll just talk about how they fit in firstly. The International Accounting Standards Committee is a committee of the Institute focused on monitoring and contributing to the development of international accounting standards. Members include Tony Coleman, who is a member of the IASB's Insurance Working Group, and Greg Martin, who is a contributor to the AASB advisory panels on insurance accounting and on financial instruments. Grant Robinson was involved in AMP's conversion to IFRS in 2004-05 and has been a convener of the IASC since 2007. Richard Land has had 20 years financial services experience with Aviva, MLC and AXA, reporting under the MOS and IFRS environments. Hua Bui is a director at KPMG Actuaries since 2004, having previously held various roles at National Mutual, ACNL and Tower Australia. In these roles, but particularly in her current role, Hua works extensively with Australian and international insurers and fund managers operating under a range of accounting and prudential standards, both in an advisory capacity and audit capacity. She has been a member of the International Accounting Task Force since 2008. Over to you. Thank you.
So our committee's presentation is going to be in three parts. Firstly, I'll provide a background into recent history of the development of an international accounting standard for insurance contracts. Then Hua will provide a little bit more detail of the IASB's emerging model for insurance contracts. And Grant will provide some implications for profit emergence and also provide an update on the timetable. I've got to say that I feel a kinship at the moment with fellow actuaries who have chosen to spend their Friday afternoon talking about international accounting standards, and you just don't get that in the wider community, so thanks. Just in context, obviously we have an IFRS for investment contracts, and we don't have an IFRS for insurance contracts. IFRS 4 tells us to revert to our local accounting standards, and in our case, that's margin on services. So the IASB has been working on an insurance contract standard since 2004 with a discussion paper issued in 2007, an exposure draft for the standard due next month in June 2010, and then a final standard anticipated next year. To complicate matters, the FASB from the US only joined the project in the second half of 2009, and it's fair to say they brought some conservative views to the table and put the timetable under pressure. So as the slide says, where significant differences of view remain between the IASB and the FASB, both views are likely to be presented in the exposure draft next month. The issue will then be discussed, utilising the feedback, and somehow resolved when the final standard is settled. So it could make for an interesting standard, bearing in mind that in relation to deferred acquisition costs and risk margins, they're pretty much divergent views between those two, so it could be quite interesting next month. And just to affirm, the focus of this presentation is on life insurance perspective. I'll backtrack to the May 2007 discussion paper because that provided the framework for what is now the emerging model that the IASB has. So it was based on a current exit value model, which means that the liability is the amount an insurer would expect to pay to transfer its remaining contractual rights and obligations immediately to another entity. And as that's not really observable very often in the market, they provided three building blocks to calculate that. The first one being current estimates of future cash flows, the second one being time value of money or discounting of those future cash flows, and the third one being a risk margin. So it's a little bit about like what we'd consider to be a best estimate liability with risk margins. And as with a best estimate liability, profit does arise at inception and is used to offset the acquisition costs. In the discussion paper, the recognition of future premiums was tied to guaranteed renewability. I'll just, in the interest of time, touch on a few concerns with the discussion paper, because some of these have been addressed in the IASB's emerging model now. So primacy of market, so in other words, the exit value approach, there was concern that the insurer's actual expense basis and portfolio experience basis mightn't be relevant. If you're talking about the market, you might look at industry-wide expense basis, and auditors in particular were concerned about that approach. Obviously, with a Bell-type approach, there's substantial profit volatility and impacts of changes in assumptions would flow through to any current year profit. There was a lot of concern about own credit risk in the original discussion paper, although that's been subsequently addressed. Simply that means as your credit standing deteriorates, you actually can reduce your liability to allow for the probability you might not actually make the payments in future. So obviously very controversial, but fortunately that's been addressed in the current emerging model. And then the final point was just unclear about how unvested benefits for participating policies would be handled. OK, I'll briefly touch on targeted field testing. So the IASB did carry out the field testing in the last quarter last year, and in Australia, AMP and QBE were involved. The field testing was based not only on the discussion paper, but subsequent developments and improvements. And the results show that not allowing the deferred acquisition costs would allow for significant write-downs in equity, not surprisingly given the high upfront costs of selling insurance business. Most respondents supported discounting using the government or swap basis, and that's a topic of its own. And finally, residual margins would be significant. I'll talk a little bit about residual margins on the next slide, so we'll come back to that. Risk margins would be difficult to estimate, even for those used to doing that kind of thing. And they're probably the key points. So this is the emerging IASB model. So this is what we're dealing with now. This is how it's evolved. We're still looking at the building block approach. With the risk margin, so still the cash flows, discounting of those cash flows and adding a risk margin. But now we're looking at fulfilment value, not exit value. So clearly the insurer's own assumptions and expenses are relevant in determining the liability. All acquisition costs are going to be expensed, and the FASB is saying that no deferrals allowed. The IASB is saying that you can have incremental acquisition costs being deferred. Under the emerging model, there's no day one profit, and the residual margin is calculated to avoid that. So I might just contrast that to margin on services. So we're kind of familiar with that on margin on services. So when we sell a product, we have present value of premiums covering present value of benefits, present value of expenses being acquisition and maintenance expenses, and whatever's left over becomes the profit margin, which gets released over time. And in that way, you get a negative liability fully offsetting the acquisition expenses and no loss in the first year. So the IASB, the emerging model, is saying no day one profit, but what their model is saying is, okay, you expense your acquisition expenses in the first year, and then you do your calculation of present value of premiums covering present value of benefits, present value of renewal expenses only. So that means the residual margin is much bigger. It doesn't, which you balance for, which you solve for, is much bigger because it doesn't have to cover acquisition expenses. So therefore, the first year you'll have the acquisition expenses coming through. FASB is saying put it all through as a loss. IASB is saying you can defer some of them, and then you have the profit. But Grant will touch on that a little bit more detail on the profit emergence. The residual margin is released over the passage of time, so it's amortised, and that may mean that you'll have to keep track of tranches of business as you sell them, so that could be interesting. And a key item which our committee and the Institute's feedback on is that the residual margin is locked. So unlike margin on services, where if you change your assumption, it gets absorbed by present value of profit margins and then run off over future, you would lock your residual margin and assumption changes go through current year profit. And the final point, importantly, own credit risk is excluded. We still have the building blocks in the emerging IASB model. I won't go into detail of those. So A is basically the cash flows as before. B is discounting or net present value of those. C is a risk margin, as we had in the original discussion paper. And D is now the residual margin to eliminate day one profits. A key point there is that C and D, the FASB would amalgamate those two margins and not separate those ones out. So just on that, the measurement perspective is now clearly one of fulfilment, as we've talked about, so relates to insurer's own expenses and experience. The next one's quite interesting. It's not a deterministic projection of cash flows. It's an unbiased probability-weighted cash flow, which means including the impact of low-probability asymmetric events, or particularly if you've got any asymmetric guarantees in your liability, so it needs to allow for those. The discount is similar to margin on services relating to the liabilities. There's no deposit floor, which is pleasing. And the cash flow boundary is about when you can continue allowing for your present value of premiums until either no longer required to provide cover or having the right to fully reassess the risk of individual contract and reprice accordingly. So there, that's the history in a nutshell. And then over to Hua to talk about a bit more detail of the emerging model.
Thank you, Richard. Richard has covered quite a bit of what the model will look like, so I'd like you to keep that big picture in mind so that when I make the specific point about the model, then you have it in the right framework. All right, so I will cover the three key issues that the ISB model, as it stands, would probably represent for Australian actuaries. And the three key issues are the risk margin, the deferred acquisition cost, and the residual margin, and what it means for us, right? Now, just to backtrack a little bit, the risk margin is what you're required to cover the uncertainty that arising from having to meet the obligation, and it is required to be updated every year in the same way that your current estimate is updated every year. This is a very contentious issue with both the IASB and the FASB board. Basically, the IASB wants a risk margin because it reflects the nature of the estimate, which is highly uncertain for insurance contract. But the FASB board is much more towards having a composite margin. So if you're not going to have any profit emergence at the start, the FASB doesn't see that there should be two separate margin, a risk margin and a residual margin. It thinks that there should only be one composite margin, and that would achieve the same impact. It doesn't see the point of explicitly identifying the risk margin. At the moment, there's no agreement, so it is likely that you might see both of those position tables. The staff of the ISB have proposed that the methodology for determining the risk margin is left to the professional body, so the Institute of Actuaries internationally or, you know, your local actuaries or professional bodies would recommend and provide guidance on how exactly to determine the risk margin. But the ISB is of the view that you should have strong disclosure on how you calculate the risk margin and the impact on alternative assumptions when arriving at the risk margin. I've put up there a range of risk margin methodologies that are currently in use, and the ISB recognises that some of those methodologies are more appropriate for some in some circumstances than others, so it doesn't rule out any of those. Now, Australian actuaries would be very familiar with the quantile method, and there are a few variants of it up there depending on how important the tail is. But basically, the quantile method is where you have a probability of sufficiency or adequacy, and you try and set your margin so that when it's added to the expected value, you get back to an amount that is sufficient to the required level of sufficiency. In Australia, general insurance, that's 75%. The cost of capital method is very popular in Europe, and it's already been basically endorsed by the Chief Risk Officer Forum. It is probably conceptually a lot simpler. It doesn't require a distribution to be adopted or assumed, but it does require a capital framework to be already in place so that you can then say, how much capital do I need? What is the cost of providing that capital? And that is my risk margin. The contention under that method is, of course, how much you charge for your capital, how much above risk-free should you be looking for. And there are other methods up there. For example, you can calculate a risk margin for every uncertainty and then add them up and allow for diversification and so on. The second issue, and it is quite a big issue, is what you do about acquisition cost. Now, I want to explain the expensing of acquisition costs is never an issue, and it's never an issue in Australia either. At the moment, we expense all acquisition costs. All it means is that you don't have an explicit DAG on your balance sheet. But the contention is how much implicit deferral should you have within the policy liability, and that's where there's no agreement yet, but as you will see, whoever win, it will be a big change, or it seems to me to be a big change for Australia. The ISB favours that you defer incremental costs only, so commission, for example, but FASB favour nothing, favour no deferral at all. Now, that seems to be quite harsh, and the reasoning for that is consistency with the revenue project. Back in March of last year, we ran an insight session to inform members of the revenue project. The revenue project is actually not a lot broader than insurance. It's across all accounting standards, and it's basically talk about how soon should you be able to recognise revenue. The principle involved is you shouldn't recognise revenue before you deliver the key obligation. Now, for insurance, this is the point of contention. If you consider that the key obligation delivery is the provision of cover, then and you don't consider that setting up a policy is a service, you don't consider that provision of advice is a service, and you don't consider that payment of commission to an agent is a service to the policyholder, then you haven't provided any service and therefore you shouldn't have any revenue. So that's how they arrived at the position of you shouldn't have any deferral of acquisition within the policy liability. As you could see, either position will result in Australian insurer having to defer a lot less than we are currently accustomed to. And the last issue is the residual margin. I think Richard's speech actually covered quite well already, so I won't spend too much time on it. But essentially, to ensure no profit at inception, the residual margin needs to be calculated as a balancing item, and it's calibrated to the premium at the start. It cannot be negative, obviously, and it has to be released with time or expected claims. Now, if you think about it, it sounds pretty much like Moz at the moment, except that it's locked in, right? If you have to lock it in and you are expected to change assumption for your current estimate and your risk margin, then a plausible scenario is you could set your assumption at the start as conservatively as is plausible, and that will reduce the residual margin. And then the next year, what you could do is in fact set your assumption back to your best estimate, and the net impact of that would be to upfront a lot of profit that you weren't allowed to upfront the first year. All right, so that's the consequences of having everything else is current estimates every year, but except for the residual margin being locked in. Now, there's no agreement, by the way, about what should be locked in either. Is it a dollar amount or is it a present value? So in March of this year, the Institute of Actuaries of Australia made a submission to the ASB pointing out what we believe are unintended consequences of locking in the residual margin while making everything else is current estimates for every year. Yeah. Basically, our argument is that for life insurance, the impact of changing assumptions is very large compared to the current year profit because it's usually a very long-term contract. And so it will swamp the current year profit. And locking in the residual margin basically allow companies the scope for managing profits and also the scope for upfronting profit to a much earlier stage than envisaged by the revenue project, for instance. And not surprisingly, our recommendation is that the residual margin should be remeasured every year whenever the current estimates are remeasured and the risk margin are remeasured, that they should be the profit should be explained in terms of experience profit and planned profit so that it gives the market a clearer view of the current experience relative to management expectations, and it increases discipline on assumption setting, avoiding the cases of, you know, really conservative at the start and then best estimates later, and also have significant disclosure on the impact of change of assumption on both the residual margin and the risk margin and the policy liability. I need to touch on participating. All of those three issues will impact non-PAR as well as PAR business, and so whatever is decided on those three issues will flow through to participating business. The key disagreement about participating business is that the ISB believe that all cash flows should be considered in the projection and is classified as liability, whereas the FASB thinks that there should be a division between non-guaranteed and guaranteed cash flows. The guaranteed part should be liability and the non-guaranteed should be equity. I will now hand over to Grant, who will take you through some very interesting graphs.
As Warren and Richard have mentioned, this thing is continuing to evolve, and so we're having a bit of fun. Originally, this was meant to be out in December, and it's now looking into June, and it may be even lucky to get there at that stage. So it's a bit like reading the Elm Trail. Some things have moved on from what's in the presentation and stuff already. And so, for example, on the issue that we brought before about doing risk margins, the latest paper going to the May board suggests they're a lot more likely to be prescriptive because some board members are very nervous about people having choices. These sorts of things. So things are moving. Yeah, one piece of good news in this is that although the latest paper says residual margins should still be locked because that's what the board's decided, at least the ISB did, on composite margins, one of the methods that suddenly emerged out of left field looks remarkably like what we've proposed in this piece here for residual margins. So there may be some hope of getting some sense, but who knows with all of this at the moment. Anyway, what I'm basically going to take you through briefly now is just trying to show what some of these profit signatures would look like between what we currently see under MOS and under IFRS. And for a yearly renewable risk book, this is just a similar example of a block of business being sold all 20-year terms, so it's nice and easy for my model to handle. And MOS, nice even profit. And as you expect under IFRS, you get a loss at day one. The size of the loss depends on how much acquisition costs you have to defer. And effectively, that then flows through into a larger ongoing profit margin because you've now got into the future. So it's fairly simple. The interesting thing then comes to, okay, what happens when we actually do assumption changes? And this is where you get a quite interesting difference from MOS. under margin on service, you're all aware, if you change the example we've got here, change the assumption at the end of year 5, I'm now expecting my claims from year 5 to be worse, GFC, whatever, by 10%. And the model assumes that the actual and expected are from that point on the same. Under margin on services, you just end up resetting your profit margin at the end of year 5, and it flows through into lower profit margins from year 6 onwards, which is what we're all used to. Under the IFRS proposals, the impact is pretty much the same. You capitalise all of that change in margins, and it comes straight through in year 5, the year in which your assumption changes, and thereafter your profit margins basically march on unchanged from what they were before this change in assumption occurred. There is a slight tweak in this, and in my simple model, I just assume that the risk margin is actually related to the expected claim, so you get a very slight tweak in profit because your risk margin goes into up as well, so you capitalise an impact to increase in risk margin in year 5 as well. And thereafter it goes on. And basically you see the same impact no matter what assumption you changed. And then one of the ones that was interesting in the back of my mind was everybody says that basically the reason why you get a bond rate impacts on risk books in Australia is because of DAC. Well, you'll still get a bond rate impact on risk books on this, even though you won't necessarily have a DAC. That's basically because you end up PVing the change in the what's your best estimate liability moves, and your residual margin in this model just sits there totally unchanged, running off in the future. So you still end up with a DAC impact, even with no DAC for bond rate changes. The next slide starts to say, okay, what does it look like for a par book? I thought it would be even more interesting. And when I put this together, it somewhat surprised me. This is to make it life easy, because my modelling skills aren't too good, so I didn't try a whole of life for endowment group. I just picked a nice, simple retail investment account par book with crediting rates running, once again, for a 20-year maturity, everything. Again, at the front end, you get the usual loss because you can't offset all your acquisition costs. But the thing that did somewhat surprise me on this model is, effectively, I got a very large profit release right at the back end because I got a large maturity payment at the back end, whereas on the models you're getting a release of profit as each year as you do the crediting. Here you only get the profit release as you actually pay the claim benefits out. So it's further back-ended. And even more interesting is, in the incremental one, which somewhat surprised me, the profit in year 1 even is actually still lower than it is under MOS, and that's because of the need to actually back-end that profit end to the other end. So you're going to end up with lower profit, possibly even with an incremental DAC. And effectively, you'll see interesting things. So if you go to the next one, which is basically saying, OK, what happens if I actually change my future investment assumption? And we're all used to this being nicely smoothed into the future margins and emerging, etc. Well, not in this world anymore. Basically, the impact of all the changes on the cash flows and discounting rates and the profit share is basically going to come straight through into the current period. So effectively, the change in the PV of the shareholder profit margin is going to be booked in the year in which it occurs, and then you're going to have a residual margin that keeps just marching on again as though nothing had changed. So par book is going to look very different from the way it currently looks under these proposals. Under this model that I put in, I didn't actually put in a risk margin, mainly put in a cost of guarantee, which will be effectively the same sort of thing as well. So actually modelling this stuff properly is going to be a bit more interesting than it is under MOS, etc., where we can basically assume the symmetry is well enough below the floor that it usually doesn't cause a problem. And then this is basically the timetable. About the one good news on the timetable is the one thing that doesn't seem to be moving is the June 11, 2011 for the balloting of the final standard. And the main issue the ISB has there, that if it moves beyond that, they're going to end up with a number of new board members, in which case they've either got a very large education, and also the key board member who's been driving this whole project, which is Warren McGregor, steps off as well. So if they go beyond that date, they're probably going to end up with a very different balloting results from what they expected going into it. So they're really committed to somehow getting there and somehow basically getting an outcome, and they've got to get an outcome that's, because it's a joint project, that basically both FASB and the ISB in the end of the day can live with. And given their very different positions around views of risk margins, composite margins and DAC, etc., I'm not quite sure where this one's really going to land, and I've got a feeling that basically the approach is going to be here's the hopefully all the correspondents will come back and somehow tell us which way we should be going, which seems a bit unlikely. And we may have clarity by June 2011, so I suspect that this standard is not going to be mandatory before about 2013, 2014, because they're not going to tell people whether you need to do risk margins or not until the middle of 2011. Then people are going to need a bit of time to actually work it out to put it all into place, so they can't really make the standard come into force too fast. So that's basically a quick out view. But any sort of changes are possible between now. They're still trying to get to an idea that they can get to a common position before the end of June, but I don't think they will on some of these key issues. So just open it up to questions.
What I'll do is, do you want to take a seat? And yes, I'll let you share that. Just pass this around. If you can speak into the microphone, mention your name first, please.
Daniel Levy, PricewaterhouseCoopers. Intrigued by the playing around with the risk margins to change profit, that would seem to work for one cohort, but are you suggesting that if you've got a portfolio over several years, that that's actually an effective technique?
I really don't know. I haven't looked at that stuff. I mean, the interesting thing is the latest May board paper is basically suggesting that the definition of a portfolio for all of this will be effectively the same as this is an IFRS, but basically just in a portfolio. So when you come to risk margins, there'll be no diversification between your portfolios allowed. And then within when you're setting residual margins and your composite margins, the view is that it should be done by year of entry as well within the portfolio. And then within the portfolio, given that there are different terms that stuff is running off, which is also subdivided by basically the expected term to maturity as well. So there's going to be an awful lot of entertaining work for modellers and an enormous amount of painful work of actually figuring out what the starting point is in historic books. They're going to be real reality. There's just too much up in the air to really be sure what this is all going to look like yet, I think.
Grant, just the switch right on the base of the...
Sorry.
Anthony Bice from Oliver Wyman. It seems that in spite of a number of years of discussion with the FASB, they just don't get it, and they're actually taking things even in an even more bizarre direction than what they were talking about a few years ago. The one that I guess I'm most concerned with out of all of those is if we think that accounts are, the purpose of accounts is to illuminate rather than obfuscate, then this idea of not presenting the residual margin as a separate item seems to be absolutely ridiculous. If those of us who still remember back to embedded value and value of new business, effectively the residual margin is, as far as I can tell, the value of new business, which to my mind is an important piece of information, even if it doesn't actually flow through the primary accounts. And so to not show that just seems crazy.
I agree with you. I think the two things that seems the most crazy is to let the current estimate move and require the risk margin to move and fix, at the same time, fix the residual margin or not have it explicitly split out. That seems to be the worst possible combination because it gives you volatility of profit, the possibility of being able to manipulate profit or manage profit and release it as when you want it, as long as you can justify your current estimate, and also open the possibility of... I lost my train of thought. Open the possibility of... earning revenue earlier than you should be earning it. So it failed by its own definition at least three criteria that I could see.
Does it mean that we'll see the rise of embedded values again?
I'm sure there'll be many interesting ways of trying to explain why you should ignore all this, and investor reports will be... But there will be a lot of disclosure sitting around this as well, which will be, you know, you're sitting at all your residual margins, your risk margins, where everything's moving and all the rest of that. So be quite a lot of work. But certainly I know back in February the
International Association of Insurance Supervisors got rather concerned with where things were going, and they actually had Rob Essendon do a presentation to the joint boards in their February meeting, basically explaining it's all very nice cobbling things together from all over the place, but please stand back and just double sanity check that the thing works as a whole. And they illustrated as the two key issues was the deferred acquisition costs, and that message seemed to have partly got through because they then went back to the boards in March and re-put a paper back in April, and effectively the ISB at that stage decided to revert back to allowing incremental acquisition costs. And that stage, FASB then decided it was time to fall out of bed on risk margin. Probably as a quid pro quo, I don't know.
So just in terms of whether embedded value will come back again, well, I guess when the CFO is looking at his levers to how he can improve the current year's profit, then what he can do is he can look at assumptions, which is obviously not a good thing. The other thing he can do is just cut back totally on writing new business so you don't get the strain. And the final thing is to try and get your surrender rates up on your investment business so that it gets up lots and lots of surrender penalties. So, in terms of explaining and managing the business, I probably agree that maybe embedded value will come back a bit more.
Other questions?
Suzanne Soldra, and you've possibly answered one of my questions by saying that the residual margin is done on the whole cohort of business. But what actually happens if a company writes loss-making business? Would it need to calculate a risk margin and apply that? And then, so they'd need to have best estimate liability plus risk margin and recognise any loss relative to that?
Under the ISB model, effectively, you recognise losses once you can't cover your risk margin. Under the FASB model, I think effectively they've agreed that there should be loss recognition, but it's at, like it is at MOS, which is basically if you can't cover your best estimate liability.
And I've got another question as well. On one of the earlier slides, I think it was Richard, had a comment about cash flow boundaries. I think this is probably the same thing as treatment of future premiums. So you would only include future premiums and future claims and expenses that are likely to arise in the policy under certain conditions. If you could just go through what the conditions are of when you would include future premiums.
Yeah, they basically voted on that one and got an agreement on that, I think, in the April board meeting, late April. So effectively what they've now got to is it's either the earlier when the policy terminates or you don't have to renew it. So it's basically all about accepting renewal premiums and the cash flows that arise out of renewal premiums. And renewal premiums and the cash flows that arise out of the renewal premiums are basically in so long as you don't have a complete right to fully underwrite. In the case of risk book, that means effectively you can take account of the individual's current health circumstances, so you have to do a full re-underwriting. Otherwise, it's in. I'm not quite clear what that means for a pure par book where you haven't got the insurance cover.
I've got a comment first, then a question. The comment is, I think this is a load of rubbish, and I think Grant's slides prove that. And the question is, what can be done about it? It's obviously subject to a range of political accounting forces, and what can realistically be done to get to a better outcome?
That's a good question. It's been one that's certainly been at the back of my mind and exercising around there. You have to think, well, as a institute, we put submissions in. They have a little bit of weight. You think if you've got people like there who are clearly more unbiased or seen as being more unbiased, like the International Association of Insurance Supervisors, basically telling them to be a bit more careful and thoughtful than they are, and they presumably carry a lot more weight than we do as a body on the international stage, then I think the only other one is effectively a fully investors come back and basically say this whole thing is just going to be a nonsense in the investor community, but I'm not sure how much they're listening to them in this debate yet or understand it.
I just want to add that when I've been following these, I've noted that the way the ISB work is it has staff preparing papers on single subject and they consider each subject on its own. And so if you think about all of the issues that we've been discussing, the decisions could be quite sensible on their own, except for the last one. But when taken together, it does give you a much worse overall picture. So to answer Bruce's question, I think one of the ways that we could influence this is actually to encourage the International Standard Board to look at it as a whole, like the big picture, now that they've resolved each of the differences underneath, to actually stand back and look at it in the total picture.
We've still got time for one more question.
If no one else wants to ask one. Grant, have you actually sent those charts to the IASB and the FASB and asked them to kind of talk you through them?
I don't think you would actually get a response. Basically, we did do a submission and we actually used a much simpler case, which is an example that Greg Martin worked through, basically illustrating why, if you follow a MOZ approach, and even if your estimates of future cash flows are out, you get a much more sensible profit emergence. It looks sensible, it gets in towards the right answer, and doesn't create an awful lot of noise. Now, the only good thing we can see coming out of that is it looks like that's turning up as a composite margin methodology. Somehow that may come into the back door somewhere else, but it's a bit of a funny political process going on and horse trading and the rest of it. I think the ability to actually get sensible outcomes is fairly challenging in the circumstances. When you think, for example, around the revenue standards, effectively there's a view that that's a bit of a nonsense, especially for long-term large construction companies like Halliburton and the rest of the very long-term construction contracts. So they've got very influential people who are able to influence and lobby better than we are, like US vice presidents on their board, and they don't seem to have too much leverage on FASB.
I think I'll just make two comments. The other thing we must remember is that this is an insurance contract, so it applies to all sorts of insurance, and life insurance is just one part of it. So we, in this room, we're probably thinking long-term policies, whole of life or YRT. YRT is actually a big product in Australia, but it's a very minor product for the rest of the world. And the other issues that come up when we discuss them ourselves is volatility of result. Volatility of result is what the general insurers are used to and expect. And so if you say this will give you a very volatile result, they say that's the right answer. So you've got to say things that appeals to a cross-section of practitioners, including accountants, and we need to be prepared to explain why life insurance should be different, because the default is you shouldn't be different. If you want to be different, you have to explain why, and in some way I can understand that. Right? We need to come up with arguments that really make sense to the rest of the insurance sector as well.
Well, can I just say quickly to add to that, while I was involved in the superannuation submissions with the superannuation IFRS standard, and we had the same issues continually that in Australia we have contributions tax, and it's not common in other jurisdictions in the world, perhaps one, Sweden I think it was, and the whole standard just didn't understand it and couldn't reflect it. So I think you've picked up a very relevant point that our products, if they're different to the rest of the world, will just be ignored in the global landscape. And I do note that when we made our submissions from an institute perspective, they got rolled into the International Actuarial Association submission, which then moved to such a high level, it glossed over and lost all of the actual detail. So I'm curious to know, has a similar approach happened with our local submission into an international actuarial?
No. On the internet, to the International Accounting Standards, we actually do our own submissions directly both to the AASB, and that's one of the things we're working on is to figure out how we can help influence the AASB's own submission around the issue, and we do one directly to the International Standards Board and allow the International Actuarial Association to do its own, which we put influence in. Mainly we have Dave Finesse involved in that process and also Bob Buchanan more informally. But that one tends to be more of a committee, such a high-level committee process that it tends to lose stuff. So we basically tended to always to do our own direct submissions independently of the International Accounting, the International Association.
Okay, on that note, we might conclude. I'd like to, on behalf of the Institute and everyone in the room, thank you all, Richard, Grant and Hua, for a very stimulating presentation, and we all wish you the best in furthering your aims in this area.